Welcome, everybody, to the Kane and Rith podcast. Today, we are in Volume 13, Issue 610. We will be talking about Yakuza Like a Dragon. The last game in the Yakuza franchise? That's not fair. But the last game titled in the West as Yakuza, before they made the pivot. It is the first turn-based JRPG in the long-running Sega Yakuza series that you've probably listened to us talk about before. Joining me, Brian Edwards, today is Carl Moon.
Hey, everyone.
Leah Haydu.
Nani.
And Rich Davison.
Good evening.
Well, welcome, everybody. So what is there to say about Yakuza at this point that we haven't talked about? This time we were talking about the start of the Ichiban saga. I don't know what you call it, but certainly a pivot, I would say. Like I said, it's part of the ongoing Like a Dragon franchise, which we've received now almost all of the games in that franchise have had a Western release. There's still a couple that haven't. I am optimistic with the release of Like a Dragon Ishin last year that maybe we will get. What's the other one? Gaiden, is that correct? Or yes. That we might get a Western release of that, hopefully, over the course of time. This one was released on January 16th, 2020, for basically all platforms, PlayStation, Xbox, and Windows. So we'll kind of go through our personal histories here. It's going to be interesting because I think that we've all, at least myself, Leah, and Rich, have been on Yakuza shows before. Now, Carl, have you been on any of the Yakuza Kane and Rinse recordings before, or is this your first one?
It's my first one.
Oh, nice. So why don't we start with you, because I think the people will probably be more familiar with our histories than yours. So how did you come to Yakuza in general, and particularly this one?
So my first Yakuza was the very first Yakuza on PlayStation 2. I picked up the game and I tried to play it and realized that my PlayStation 2 was knackered. I tried to play it on the PS3 and there was always a bug where the game would hard lock if you were doing it on backwards compatibility and you used to have to download an old save file. And it never felt like my game. And it was a series that I always wanted to try and get into more. You know, we had Yakuza 3 and 4. On the PlayStation 3, I tried those, couldn't really get into them because, you know, I hadn't played the first two. And, it was always a series that I've enjoyed from the fringes. I've loved the fandom. I've loved everything around them. The history, the legacy of them has always been super interesting to follow, albeit from afar. And I've always owned all of the mainline titles on those systems. So it's a strange one that this one that we're going to talk about is actually the first one that I completed end to end.
Oh, cool.
So that's quite an interesting turn because obviously, as I'm sure we'll cover, you mentioned there is essentially a pivot. So it felt like this was where I could actually go and make my mark on the series and really join in, despite obviously following the story and the flow and several speed runs of the previous Yakuza games. Over all the years and owning them, yeah, it feels very strange to go, yeah, but this is the first one I actually really played proper.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of my history is a little bit probably unusual coming into Yakuza Like a Dragon.
Yeah, nice. It is interesting with this one, right? You talked about the pivot. As far as my personal history, I've told this a version of the story before, is that this was my first Yakuza game. I owned some of the other ones on PS Plus over the years, and I dabbled. Like, I think I at one point tried to play Yakuza 3 coming in cold and just be like, what is going on? You had no idea.
Yeah.
But this was the first one I got, and the reason that I played it at all, which kind of happenstance and pure luck considering how I end up feeling about the franchise, is it came when the Xbox Series X was released. I was able to secure one on launch day. But it was an online order that was a bundle, and so I had to buy it with two games, and it came with Gears Tactics and Yakuza Like a Dragon for the Xbox Series X. So it was either don't get an Xbox or buy two games I wasn't sure that I was going to be interested in, and because I am someone who needs to have the thing immediately and have no patience, I got the bundle. So I got Yakuza Like a Dragon with my Xbox Series X, and it was one of the first games I played on my new console. And I remember being really intrigued by it and just kind of poking at it and then eventually kind of got down underneath the surface. And from then on, for those of you who have listened, you know it's been quite the saga for me. I have now completed all the Yakuza games in the franchise that are available to me, except for Yakuza. I always want to call it Dead Cells, but it's not called Dead Cells. What's it called?
Dead Souls.
Dead Souls.
Dead Souls. Yeah, there it is. And I am currently 50 hours into Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth. So obviously I've gone down quite the rabbit hole and have played a lot of these games. Now, Leah, you kind of have the reverse effect, right? Because you've only recently played this game for this recording, correct?
Yeah, so I did start the Yakuza series with Yakuza 0, and mm-hmm. I'd kind of been aware of the series before, but I had I think I've probably mentioned, I like you, Brian, have been on all of the previous Yakuza shows. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure this is kind of out there, but I had kind of been aware of the series, but I had this picture in my mind of what it was that really wasn't what it is. So it wasn't something that I was like avoiding, or, you know, it just wasn't something I ever got around to. And then once Zero came out and I started hearing really good things about that, played that and loved it. Not too long after I played it for the first time, I'd also played Yakuza Kiwami, the remake of Yakuza 1, mm-hmm. By the time we started covering the games on the Kane and Rince podcast a few years ago. So I decided, rather than to kind of push forward, even though I really enjoy what I've played so far, I decided to kind of hold back so that I could be playing them for the show, basically.
Sure, yeah.
So, yeah, I started with Yakuza 0, went all the way through 6, and then for the show, I have played Like a Dragon. Although, this is my my mea culpa here. I did not finish the game in time for this recording. I know. So I'm fired, but I'm going to stay here anyway until somebody kicks me out of the call. but yeah, I'm stuck on what I think is the last boss. So I think I probably honestly just need to go and grind a little bit more and then go back. But I'm right at the end, but I thought I was good, but we'll talk about it, but there's some pretty significant yeah. difficulty spikes in this game that gave me a little bit of trouble. So but still mostly finished it and looking forward to whatever we decide to do with the series on the podcast going forward.
Yeah, it is. We've received some correspondence about those issues as well that we'll get to in a bit. Definitely has some of that to it. It'd be fun to talk about. Now, Rich Davison, I don't mean to put you on the spot and to put you last, but I'm doing both. You probably, I would say, out of the four of us, have had what I would call, and if this is unfair, tell me, the most tumultuous relationship with the Yakuza franchise. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I don't think that's unfair at all. Yeah. Okay. As an interesting aside, the 8th of March 2020, so literally yesterday at the point of recording, 4 years ago, Leah and I were on the Yakuza 0 show. And for those who haven't quite heard that show, you probably recall that I actually found that game to be not upsetting necessarily, but slightly offensive. And I think in my summary, I mm-hmm. did say that I could almost see the appeal of a game like this, but maybe it was me that was the problem. And that kind of leads into my particular history with Like a Dragon. I picked it up in May, so the 17th of May 2021, which was around about a month after I picked up my PS5. I'd finished through Demon's Souls, and I had just a gap in my calendar, if you like, and decided to pick up Like a Dragon, because ultimately the biggest barrier for entry for me in Yakuza 0, which is the only other one in the series that I played, was I found the combat to be fairly frustrating.
Okay, yep.
And so I thought maybe the turn-based kind of nature of Yakuza 0 will be a bit more agreeable with my sensibilities. Where I'm at with the game, I played it through to 100% at the time. I then went and played a replay through around about a month ago, just in preparation for the show. I did flirt with getting the platinum trophy for this game. Whether that's out of enjoyment or out of spite, I think we'll get into that as we go through the recording. I'm not quite there. There is the Millennial Tower, the extreme version of that, where there's a trophy that's locked behind that, and that is an exceptional level of effort. So I've put the hours in. I put around about 120 hours into this game. I think I've got some fairly strongly formed feelings and thoughts on sure. where we are, but I'll keep my powder dry as we go through.
Nice, thanks. So I think it's not strange that a lot of us came to this game in different time frames and forms regarding our histories with the series, because as we've already mentioned a couple times, it was a big pivot, and this was maybe, at least to my recollection, as just being Joe Western consumer, was the first one that got kind of a real push and had some buzz around it. Yakuza 0 definitely had that, but I feel it was more after the fact. While this game, like, I feel like I was seeing things about it beforehand. Like, there was a lot of build up, a hype of what are they going to do post Kiryu, in big air quotes, which we now know to be not post Kiryu at all, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, so it did get kind of more attention in the West, at least certainly for me in the podcasts and kind of news outlets I follow. So it's not surprising that we all kind of have different stories of how we got to where we are today. But as far as the game itself, it sold fairly well, according to Wikipedia. It was the best-selling print game in the first 4 days in Japan, with over 300,000 copies sold. And then by December 2023, it had sold 1.8 million units worldwide, and 400,000 of which being in Japan. And those numbers have probably gone up because it's been included in multiple PS Pluses, Game Passes, bundles, sales, things like that. It is worth noting that, as Richie mentioned it, and I forgot to mention in my summary, that when I did replay this game, I replayed it on my Steam Deck recently, and that was a really nice way to experience the game. So it's kind of available everywhere but Switch, so if you have an opportunity, you probably have something that is available to play it. From the forum, T-Bone254 says, I had just finished a playthrough of Chrono Cross and was looking at something else to dive into. I usually like to switch the genres up with each new game, and since I just finished a pretty epic journey with a JRPG, I figured I would try my hand at a brawler. I had heard of the Yakuza series before, but had never played through them, and since the latest Yakuza game was just released on Game Pass, I figured it would be the perfect start. I'm sure you'll see the irony here. By the time I realized the game was a turn-based RPG, it was too late. My wife and I, she typically watched me play through games, were hooked. Kasuga is just too charming. He's a giant, nerdy goofball with a massive heart of gold and endless enthusiasm. He's easily one of my favorite video game characters. While Kasuga certainly provides most of the appeal for me, the entire cast brings enough to the game to be entertaining throughout. So, to get into the start of this game, there's a lot of changes from the series. We can talk about combat, we can talk about all sorts of things, but primarily it's not the first time the Yakuza game has started with a different protagonist. I believe in Yakuza 4, it starts with you playing as Akiyama, who was a new character, at least to us at the time. So it's not without this, but this was certainly billed as a brand new protagonist, a move on from the Dragon of Dojima. So I just kind of would like to pool everybody's thoughts. So from that initial section, when you're in Kamurocho, you're with Ichiban, and you're kind of learning who he is, figuring out his backstory, those first few hours of the game, how did he strike you as a protagonist from the beginning?
So I think what I had mentioned on Slack was that Ichiban is a really great guy, and I liked him immediately, but he's a terrible Yakuza. Like they really set him up as somebody who does what he thinks is right, as opposed to what is necessarily always expected of him, unless what's expected of him is expected by Arakawa, and in that case, just no questions at all, ever. Side note, when when I started playing, and you know, they speak about several members of the Arakawa family, all I could think about for a little while was Minoru Arakawa, who was the former president of Nintendo. And I don't know, that name kind of struck a chord with me. I'm like, where have I heard that before? And I went and looked it up, and of course it's him. So just a side note, kind of silly, but yeah.
So my thoughts on him from that initial section, like you said, he's clearly like a lead with his heart. Definitely a bad Yakuza, more of a good guy, but he also, like, he just seemed goofy, and in a way that, like, all of the supporting cast of Kiryu seemed goofy, but in a way that Kiryu never did. Now, granted, a lot of that for me is in hindsight, because I played this game first before the others. So the switch for me from Ichiban to Kiryu was definitely like a whoa, you know, like kind of like a holy cow, this guy's serious. Now, Rich, you had played Yakuza 0 before this, is this correct?
I had, yeah. And the way that I described Kiryu was as a dullard, and I kind of stand by that based around my my own experience of just the one game. Ichiban is the opposite. Ichiban is like a 41-year-old man-child, essentially, which kind of works for the game. So there's in terms of summary, Ichiban ends up going to prison, basically taking the rap for another member of the Yakuza and spends 20 years in prison, which he was delighted by, which is a very alien thought. What I find quite frustrating about Ichiban in particular was, well, not frustrating, actually, I think it was frustrating to begin with, and I was worried that it was going to persevere throughout the game, was that he was going to be like a sort of Encino Man style man about, like, man out of time,
sure, yeah.
You know, in the first sort of however long, maybe 2 or 3 hours, you go through the sequence where he goes for a punch perm in 2020, one, I think, when this game was set, punch perms aren't really a thing, and he ends up with like a great big perm in his hair, and it's all done for yucks. But like, as the story goes along, that does abate a little bit, and he sort of, the edges get sanded off a little bit more, and I find him to be much more of an endearing, kind of wholesome character than he originally started to. And obviously just one that is kind of infinitely more kind of approachable and likable than Kiryu would be, who's stoic, based on my experience.
I kind of, and you guys can tell me if you think this is a fair observation or not, but I kind of took away from Ichiban that he is more of a Western style protagonist than Kiryu is. Whereas Kiryu, as Rich said, is very kind of stoic and does not show a ton of outward emotion. Kasuga does. Like, he is forever, you know, virtues of friendship, and you know, just he wears all of his emotions on the outside as opposed to keeping them on the inside, and that makes him a lot more likable to us. But I wonder how he was received by Eastern audiences.
Yeah, I mean, especially on the back of the previous Yakuza games, which were obviously very cult. It had such a strong cult following that it was a big risk to go and leave, you know, a main protagonist who, as you mentioned, is stoic, who was a legendary Yakuza in his story, who was almost faultless in his approach, etc., etc. And then you go to some person who is almost, you could describe as potentially neurodivergent in terms of their approach of how they actually see the world. And at first it felt like they were laying it on a bit thick with his personality. And it was, because obviously I did have some familiarity with Kiryu and those games, and I'd watched a lot of them. And whilst I was really interested in playing this game, and it looked like it had loads of personality and it was hype, and you know, it almost had two releases because no one spoke about it before. It was a next gen console release, and I got really drawn into that hype and wanted to pick it up, and then it felt like, oh, is this a bit too much? Can they maintain this? Can they humanize this? And then the longer the game goes on, because, you know, you've described in one paragraph the start of the game that is about 2.5 hours in cutscenes. So it is super dense in terms of the narrative. And by about half an hour of playtime after that, I was like, no, I really, really already I like this character a lot. I can see what they're trying to do in terms of his perception of seeing the best in people and the best in situations, whilst also aligning his moral compass alongside that of Kiryu. So morally, and in terms of the structure and belief and love of the Yakuza and the principles, we had a really strong alignment. But in terms of the approach outwardly to other people and trust and personality, Ichi is so much bigger than Kiryu. And that felt like something that they could really build a essentially RPG game onto, which are historically a lot longer than action brawler games, where you can start to really invest time into those personality traits and conversations that are happening in a way that I feel that this game would have fallen flat over that same length and approach with someone that was, to quote Rich, a dullard in Kiryu.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, too, some of the stylistic choices. Rich already mentioned the hair. Obviously, his hair is for comedic effect and everything else, but making his outward suit that kind of maroon suit that was clearly the exact same color of Kiryu's shirt under his gray suit. You know,
it's an inversion because he's wearing a gray shirt under a maroon suit. Which when I finally noticed that, I got a kick out of that.
It was it definitely was showing that they were trying, certainly going for something different. And it seems to resonate with a lot of people, because as you'll hear through the correspondence and just from my own experiences too, is that he becomes a character that you very easily and very quickly would kind of, as we would say on another podcast, like you do anything for him. You know what I mean? You're kind of on that journey. Like, and he has that effect on his party members too, right? Yeah. Like Nanba, who we'll talk about in a bit, is very hesitant about almost anything, any different change, because he's got his own kind of mission behind the scenes. But Kiryu's enthusiasm for everything just kind of like it begrudgingly gets him to do things he wouldn't do otherwise. And I feel like that has the same effect on the player. At least it certainly did on me.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. I think, you know, it does not take long to realize that he is the kind of character that you could pin a franchise on. And there's a very subtle leading of events up to something that happens in the mid game of this, where you actually realize it's all very intentional to highlight the things that were missing from Kiryu as a character.
Sure. Yeah,
that you can actually build a leader of men rather than an individual, which Kiryu is very much an individual for people. Ichiban is about being a person for the people and for the betterment of people. And I think that the arc, which up until kind of the mid-game, I mean, how long are we talking? 40, 50
hours? Yeah, something like that.
You're kind of, as you said, you're on that journey with him at that point. And when the story, when you realize the intent of why Ichiban was written as a protagonist for a game in this manner, it makes so much more sense. And you're like, that is actually very clever.
Yeah.
That it's like, it's a little bit of science, right? You're taking a little bit of that trait and a little bit of that trait and a little bit of that trait, and they've masterfully created Ichiban as a character who you really do go through all the emotions of, in terms of, oh, is he too big? Oh, no, actually, he's really kind. Is he a bit dense? Is he a bit naive? And you're like, no, he's just kind of the right amount of all these things to be human.
Yeah. I think that might be quite deliberate. And I think, something that I'd never really considered, but you've certainly sort of unlocked this in my brain, is I think it is quite intentional. I think it is specifically designed for like a more Western audience. Like if you look at the traditional trajectory of Yakuza, start off on PS2, really struggled to get its kind of grounding in the West until PS4 with Yakuza 0, which was essentially not a soft reboot, but an alternative way into the series with established characters. So to find that Ichiban basically kind of has a lot of the same sensibilities as Kiryu, but is more expressive and is a new take in a new environment with a new game style, feels to me like a very kind of considered and measured way to kind of introduce people to a franchise that was otherwise fairly impenetrable. I mean, at the time that Yakuza 0 came out, had we had the kind of broader distribution of Yakuza 3, 4, 5, and 6 and made available as part of the package deals, I'm not really too sure. So all of these strategic decisions that are taking place kind of give to me that sense that what they were doing was quite deliberately trying to find a way to bring people into the stories. That also exists on that kind of ethical level as well. Like what Ichiban is as this almost like empty vessel who's just has a personality but really doesn't have many strong opinions is a sort of like blank canvas upon which the world can impress like itself onto Ichiban and you as the player, if you don't have that grounding in like Yakuza culture and specifically the culture of Yakuza games. The fact that he's so naive is a really nice way to kind of reflect and impart some of that kind of sensibilities back onto you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so that's Ichiban. Does anybody have any questions? No. Moving on from getting into the game. Yes. I can hook you up. Before we get into the bulk of the story, because this is a game, and the way we're going to kind of attack the story is less from a plot plot beat by plot beat. We're going to talk more about the characters because it's a game much more about Ichiban's group than it is about Ichiban himself, too. Before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about the visuals. As you mentioned before, Carl, it was kind of a new game, new franchise, this new console cycle, whatever you want to call it, generation, if you will, or whatever numbering system makes you happy. This game was early on both of the new consoles, PS5 and Xbox Series X. So when I first put it in, I was expecting to be wowed by graphics, right? Because that's what we want when we get a new console. You want to be blown away. And I wouldn't say that that Yakuza Like a Dragon blew me away, but I will say that the fidelity, when it specifically comes to the characters and facial expression, it has a polish that seems at some point when you're watching these characters, because you see cutscene after cutscene, it seems almost impossible how much they were able to get those characters to emote. That's my take. How did you feel about the visuals in this game? Did you, compared to the other games, do you think it was a like significant leap, or do you think it was just more of already good work that existed?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure I'm the best litmus test for this, because I basically parked my own relationship with the series a long time ago. But what I can say is, in general terms, the aspiration to go for photorealism works for me. Like, it feels like a very livable, like, understandable, legible Japanese city. Everything does kind of carry the same density and weight of like what you would expect to see. It looks very cinematic, and it's going for a cinematic style, and it succeeds in doing that. So I don't really have hugely strong feelings about the visuals in general, but if we can talk briefly about characters, I think there's a little bit of a sort of paradoxical situation where Ichiban, who is probably the most emotive character in the story, does look very cartoonish to me when compared to some of the peers and some of the bit actors that go around there. So it's a mixed bag. I think it's a mixture of style and a mixture of substance, and it blends it largely in a successful way. But it's the same thing as always the case with Kena Rinse. When you play a game to study it, it doesn't necessarily hold up in the same way if you're playing it for enjoyment. So I'm looking at the flaws, I'm looking for things, but in general, it's a kind of very level quality, and it's all pretty good. A great big thumbs up from me.
I think it's almost more of a risk for them to have gone out of Kamurocho, because I mean, it does, you are in Kamurocho for a couple of chapters, or, you know, pieces of the story, but that's been kind of your main place for basically the rest of the Yakuza series. Mm-hmm. And having this new, well, mostly new area to that is just as filled out and just as kind of alive and active and populated as Kamurocho is, despite not having been a main location in any of the previous games, is pretty impressive, I think. Because, you know, that they've had Kamurocho for so long, and I've talked before about how I kind of enjoy how it's the same place, but it just undergoes these subtle changes over time. But, you know, it is an old place. Like, we have seen this before, right. and we're, depending on how you feel about it, maybe you're super comfortable being there, or maybe you're a little bit bored with it. And if what you feel is that that's kind of a character in the Yakuza games, the city itself is almost a character, then I would say that is kind of tricky, and I'm curious how they handle that in Infinite Wealth also, because you're not, it's a whole new country. Like, that's not even the same country.
When it comes to other visuals, it's kind of it's an RPG battler. One of the things that I think is one of the striking changes, and we'll talk about this a little bit when it comes to the battle system in a minute, but is the changing of the scenes and the settings when you enter battle. So you will just be fighting on the street, but they'll do these like these flash transitions where, like, a guy who was just in a suit suddenly becomes a man who is has a torso of a garbage bag and two legs sticking out the bottom of him, and he's hopping around. And they explain this all away with saying that Ichiban kind of views his street battles as Dragon Quest. Quite literally, they drop Dragon Quest names dozens of times in the game. So I found that to be both hilarious and really engaging when it comes to the Tsuji deck collecting of monsters and things like that. I found each battle to be interesting, because you never knew quite. You could kind of tell by the way they looked beforehand, but then when they changed, you knew what kind of battle you were going to be in for. I'm specifically thinking of also the gentlemen who have pool floats and are, who are too lubed up with suntan lotion. Those guys made me happy every time I saw them.
Slip and sliders or something.
In big quotes, suntan lotion. That's what I told my kids that it was anyway. Some unique, more like fantasy type battle effects and things like that. But if you've played a Yakuza game before, you kind of know what you're getting into visually.
That flip into the mind of Ichiban kind of serves the game quite well, in my opinion, because it kind of opens up not just to the sort of like salacious nature of the Yakuza games, but also the kind of absurdity of it. Like there's sections where you're doing a battle one-on-one with a crane or a giant Roomba. Like these things are obviously absurd and all in the mind of this, man-child, let's say, but it actually does make for some fairly interesting breaks from normal. Like it's a really good way of kind of expressing abstract things in an otherwise fairly straight down the middle, like almost like dramatic depiction of life in Japan, I find.
The fantasy elements are, in terms of, I mentioned the character design from Ichi's party, but I do love that fantasy twist. I also love the facial reactions of his party when Ichi's kind of describing what he sees and they're all like, is this guy actually insane? And it's something, they actually refer to in Infinite Wealth at the start when they introduce that as well. And I kind of like the fact that this is all perceived from Ichiban's perspective. This is how he sees himself. The job roles paint themselves in different roles within a battle and the skills, and Ichi is the quote-unquote hero by default, from pulling the sword in the stone, which is a baseball wrapped in barbed wire, and all these different elements, and how the characters dress their outfits so you can have him in like a suit of armor and all these kinds of things, was just a really interesting take on what can be of. It's very easy to get, I don't want to say bored because it's a very negative view, but we've mentioned that they do use these environments a lot in the in the Yakuza games, and it can feel like, okay, I've seen this, and it loses the specialness of the appeal. But actually the refresh going into the battle scenes and seeing the, quite frankly, brilliantly translated westernized naming conventions for the enemies and the animations that they all have and the personalities and the designs of them, and then what you actually see from your set of heroes was so refreshing coming into Yakuza Like a Dragon and playing that after, sampling all the other ones previously. I can genuinely say in 200 hours, roughly, that I've spent playing Yakuza Like a Dragon, never got bored of that.
Yeah, it's
every time I went into the battle scenes, loved it.
So before before we get into the next section of the big plot aspects, let's talk a little bit about the audio. This is the first, I think, that in general the Yakuza games have had a really eclectic music style. This might be the first one where I felt myself paying a little bit more attention to the battle music, because I mean, I'm just going to put it out there. Dubstep is not something that I enjoy, hi, I'm Brian Edwards listening to Spotify in my car type things. But these battle themes, to me, for what you're doing and the crew that you're doing them with and everything else, they really worked. They're over the top and like blasting and just kind of nonsensical electronic beats that I just found like anytime you come across you get involved in a battle with a group of enemies that is 15, 20 levels below you, and the music hits like you are going into the final boss fight of every game you've ever played. It's an interesting choice, and I think that it really works to like set the stage for the chaos and fun of the battles.
Yeah. It's not, this is not Uematsu's like masterful symphonies of battle music. This is definitely a different direction where they've not tried to match that. And it's kind of weird that dubstep's been used, because I always feel like, didn't that stop in the Xbox 360, PS3 era of games where we got bombarded with it and then it got boring and overplayed, and then it comes back and you go, huh, this works. Like, it actually just works with the, quite frankly, insanity of everything going on around with it, with the, as I said, the changing style of the fantasy, the characters and stuff. Yeah, the battle music was, you know, I think everyone always wants their battle music to be like the Final Fantasy VII battle music, you know, and it's, but this is something that, yeah, I was aware of and I noticed and I didn't get sick of. It never felt like it was truly incredible. It's not necessarily something that I would play or when I'm playing music whilst I'm working, for example, but actually going through the game, yeah, it just like so many individual elements of this title, spoiler, I do quite like this game. It's probably known because I'm pretty sure the Kane and Rince team got sick of me just banging on about it at the launch of the Xbox One. The Xbox Series. So yeah, it's the music is just one of those other strands that I think works really, really well in this title.
I'd like to particularly thank Jobo Bonobo from our forum here for pointing out an aspect of the audio that I would not have even considered to bring up just because of my personal lens, so I really appreciate this. From the forum, Jobo Bonobo says, "This is my first time playing a Yakuza game with English voice acting, and I have to say that the voice acting was wonderful here, full of great performances. The English version of Baka Meitai, for example, turned out better than I expected with Nanba's lovely singing voice. It's heartwarming to see how far voice acting in games has progressed from the days of Jill sandwiches." I will say I never even considered playing this game in English only because I play JRPGs unless they're ones to Final Fantasy 16 might be the exception that proves the rule, but I tend to play them in whatever native language they were developed in. So I just naturally went to Japanese and I thought the voice acting was fantastic. But I didn't consider the English voice acting. Did anybody here play with English voice acting?
Yeah.
Surprisingly, I did.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Did you agree with Jobo Bonobo's assessment?
Very much so. I actually thought that the voice acting for the main crew of this game was across the board really strong. Like, really strong. I was expecting a bit cheesy, a bit kind of off, I don't know. There's something to do with the localization that happens out of Ryoga Kotoku that is just really good that not all studios have quite got yet. And I'm talking much bigger studios and much bigger titles do not get this right. And it's the little translations into a script that make the script flow and then talented voice actors to deliver those means that it actually feels like it could be a Western-developed game with an Eastern translation, but it's, you know, it's very obviously the other way around.
Yeah.
I thought particularly the voice actor of Ichi was very, very good.
Yeah, I agree. I played with the English version. The only kind of thing I would ding it for is Adachi's voice actor, Andrew Morgado, has a very distinguishing voice in English. So, like, you can hear his voice come through the performance, which sometimes does gently pull you out, but there is like a pathos in the story that they do get through in the English equivalent. And I think because I did watch Leah play a little bit of the Japanese version, the lip syncing is unique to the English version as well, so depending on what voice you go for, like, yeah. It is a very kind of legible, very believable depiction of actually the plot.
But you're right. Yeah. Adachi does sound like he's been chewing gravel for years.
That's true. Yeah. It's not a natural voice, but yeah.
And Leah, you were Japanese like me, I'm assuming?
Yeah, and for much the same reason. I typically play most modern JRPGs anyway in Japanese, and just the fact that I have played all of the Yakuza games up to now in Japanese, it just wasn't really a question for me. But I'm really glad to hear that they put that kind of effort into the English translation, and that kind of syncs up with what I was thinking about intentionally making it more appealing to a Western audience, as they tried to do that with the PS2 version of the first Yakuza, and maybe the second, I'm not sure, but it sounded more like stunt casting to me. Like they had, like actual recognizable actors. You know, Mark Hamill, I think, was he doing Kiryu? No, I think he did Majima, didn't he?
Majima, yeah, I believe. Right. Yep.
Yeah. So you know, it. Stunt casting is maybe a little bit harsh, but it was maybe not as well thought through as this one seems like it was.
So it's about an hour into the recording, so I'm assuming we should probably start talking about the gameplay a little bit.
I guess.
So it's, as we mentioned before, it's a big departure from where it was before. We got some correspondence on it. Tom Fum from the forum says, "I've never been a fan of turn-based games, let alone RPGs. When I heard Yakuza was going this way, I wasn't pleased at all. They said the Judgment series was carrying on the Brawler-style gameplay, which I played and got very bored with, so I wasn't pleased, but thought, you know, I need to try as it's Yakuza after all. And my oh my was I not disappointed. From the get-go, I was hooked with this game and soon learned the ways of turn-based games and working out what damage, what power-ups, etc., etc. It was an experience, and what better way to experience it than the world of Yakuza? This game was just as bonkers and wacky as I knew it was going to be, but also with a heartfelt story and an emotion you get from the series." And Kieran DC from the Patreon says, "By the time Like a Dragon came out, I'd spend the last 5 years playing the previous 7 games, and quite frankly, I was burnt out. I decided I would play it as a matter of routine, follow the story, and ignore most of the side content. Then I started playing it, and to my amazement, it was a turn-based RPG. Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. More ridiculous story moments, parentheses, locker baby bros, more great characters, more fun side content, and best of all, a combat system similar to Persona, both addictive and fresh." So probably the biggest thing going into this game was the discussion of a turn-based RPG. There was actually a tweet from an RGG studio, on an April 1st that showed that said the next Yakuza game was going to be a turn-based RPG, and everybody thought it was an April Fool's joke. It was not. It was not. They were doing that. It's turn-based JRPG. You know what you're getting into. It has strengths and it has weaknesses to the way they implemented it here. What I will kind of say to kick off the conversation is that I think that in general, it worked very well and I was very engaged with it. However, there were certain aspects of it that felt very much like a first try at this type of combat. Yes. And I'm interested to see what your guys' thoughts are, particularly if we're going to start with weakness first. I'm going to do the reverse compliment sandwich here, is some of the distancing stuff. There would be situations where, like, Nanba, like, would attack first, and he'd attack the person, and then it'd be Kiryu, and it'd be Ichiban, and then it'd be Adachi. But Adachi was, like, a block away still. So I would start at the attack, and Adachi would have to sprint for 50 yards before he got up to where he was going. So examples like that. Does anybody have real gripes or blessing, you know, or compliments for this, for the way they implemented turn-based RPG into Yakuza?
Can I be a JRPG hipster for a second? Is this a safe space?
Yes, okay. It is.
So I play a lot of JRPGs. I have for a very long time. And overall, I want to start by saying that I think this is a good system overall. It's not perfect, but, you know, for a first really kind of run at it from this particular studio, I think it's perfectly reasonable. It's, decent in most ways. There are a few things that I kind of I did not have the best experience with. Brian already mentioned kind of the positioning thing, which is tricky in most RPGs. Like if you are working with a positioning system, then I think it's important to really kind of make it reliable, and this isn't. And the reason I say that is because, like, there are some abilities that you will get largely later on kind of in the trees, but some of them are relatively early, that are area of effect. So they'll hit more than one person depending on where they're standing. But nobody stops. Like, they're still moving around as you are selecting your moves, as you're figuring out what exactly you want to do. Like, it's not they take their turn and then they choose a position, which is more realistic, certainly. I mean, people aren't just going to stand there while you throw fire at them or whatever, but it does kind of make it frustrating if what you're trying to do is, you know, in between the time I've chosen this area of effect ice spell or whatever and actually clicked the button to have it go off, two of the people that it was going to hit are now out of range, you know, it's not doing what I thought it was going to do when I chose it. So that was a little bit iffy for me. And the other big thing is that it's really difficult to balance fighting a lot of enemies with fighting one really hard enemy in a turn-based context. And this is kind of what I briefly mentioned before about the difficulty spikes in this game. So if you have four characters against one character, then like you're faced with the kind of problem of how do we make this seem like it's extremely difficult but not make it unfair. And I think that this skirts a little close to the unfair for me in some situations, and mainly those are the ones at the very end of the game, starting with the fight against Majima and Saijima, which was really rough. I was not expecting that particular difficulty spike, and you know, I think that it in part it is intentional that it feel a little bit unfair, because these are supposed to be these epic legendary Yakuza. They use that term a lot, but it felt a bit much to me. The other thing, this is not necessarily specific to JRPGs, but it is often found in JRPGs, is dungeon design. And this is not something that Yakuza has really done before. Like you get like the occasional thing that's closer to like the Millennium Tower from the end of this game, where you know you're inside and you're kind of running. It's sort of a dungeon in that way. This has actual dungeons, like when you go down into the sewers and you're actually just mapping out a this branch goes this way and then this branch goes this way, and it felt a little bit
Shin Megami Tensei.
Yeah,
it felt Persona 4 to me, real Persona 4 vibes. With
it
the
felt
way that
less
the,
organic yeah. than the rest of the game really did, and yeah. it, I think
it's
that's
the
why
geometry
out.
Of that place
yes.
and everything feels like it could be procedurally generated because of how fundamental it is. Leah kind of said everything really that I would nod along with. I think it. The only two observations that I would add is there is some interesting sort of thoughtful improvements that they put on there. So if you do a melee attack and there's a bicycle or a bin in the way, a character will kick the bin into another, like an enemy that's in front of it for like a small amount of additional damage. So it shows that there's some way of trying to innovate like environmental attacks, which is interesting. I think it's I don't think I've seen anything like that before in an RPG in the past. I think my main gripe with the almost sort of, embryonic state of the JRPG aspect of it is there is way, way too much over-reliance on enemies that have zero weaknesses. As you go through the game, it becomes really kind of problematic, because you build, you have jobs, you know, you have specializations in different elements. And there just is no weaknesses. And Persona does a lot of this as well, of course, but there's always a way to negotiate around it. There will be one weakness to the character, and it's about finding that out. There's many characters in this game, in particular bosses, that just have no weaknesses, so it becomes a real race of damage rather than a more strategical kind of a battle of exploiting weaknesses and taking advantage of scenarios and such.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I'm going to float right between what Leah and Rich have just said, because I actually love the organic nature of enemies moving, because it makes you either act quickly or slowly dependent on a circumstance in a way that changes the pacing of you choosing actions, which is quite unusual in a sort of a traditional JRPG context, where You there's always a luck attribute potentially that something doesn't quite hit, or you know, you'll get a crit. This is kind of sometimes you have to react quick, either the enemy's down or they're getting up, or you've got a quick chance for like a collateral attack. Where I found that the weakness was in the inability to be able to consistently utilize things like bikes and bins and that ilk that it will that it will definitely be interacted with for additional damage. And that was kind of frustrating. Spoiler, better in Infinite Wealth.
Yeah, I was just about to say, it's hard to separate, right? It is really, when you're playing both. It seems like, without making this a show about a game that it's not, that these seems to be lessons that they learn moving forward. And I think they learn them by having them be these problems here, because And yes. Leah mentioned it, Rich, well, everybody's mentioned it so far. The weapon thing's really interesting because picking up a weapon off the street and using it as just part of the environment has been such a staple of the Yakuza series, right? There's a milk crate, there's a bicycle or an oversized traffic cone, you know, whatever it is. You pick it up and you use it to bash the brains out of the guy that you're fighting. And this game attempts to use that naturally or kind of, what's the word? Exactly. But it's never quite reliable. I still remember when I accidentally got the achievement for knocking an enemy into a car and they got hit by a car and I'm like, oh, that can happen. Cool. But like, it was never presented in a way that I should be thinking about using that as a tool. It was just kind of a pure luck happenstance type of thing as opposed to a strategy that I could use within this JRPG system.
I think what might make that's the whole system more appealing to me would be if you could control your character's positioning in some way.
Sure.
Because currently you really can't. And I think that might make it feel a little bit more intentional, even if, you know, nothing changes about where the enemies are or how the enemies move. If you can actually move in taking that into account, I think it could be a bit more strategic as opposed to just waiting.
Yep, for sure.
And I think in regards to my issues with that strategic element, and it ties into a lot of what, you know, Rich and Leo have said already, is there's a range of elemental attacks in this game, and you taught it very early on, but it never really has an impact in the vast majority of fights.
Agreed.
Until the end game. There's a key part where you're fighting Majima, Sajima, etc. And Majima is actually a phenomenally easy fight if you know what to do. And the game never tells you in the best way how to understand the elemental effects. And it ties into the job system, which we'll talk about in a bit, in terms of having certain key skills from certain roles that make the end game possible. So that feels like suddenly you're going from 95% of this game where you're like, well, I thought the elemental stuff would have played a bigger part, to the last 5%, you're like, holy crap, I was completely unprepared for the elemental part of this game. And it is so weird that the balancing seems so off on that.
Yep.
And I felt like that was really frustrating. And then you've got the certain kind of skills which have like a team effect, that in the majority of combat, you never feel that you need to do anything other than heal or attack for the majority of the game. It's not balanced enough that you need to use a balanced range of skills to get through fights. So by the time you do, i.e. Tendo, you haven't really had practice in being able to set it up in advance. So you've got, like Ichiban has the... I can't remember the skill name, but it's where he braces himself for like a big impact and reduces the impact of others so that you can counter from it without getting like knocked. And it's knowing when to use these things, because for the vast majority of that, literally 99% of that game, you do not need to use it. And then all of a sudden it's like, wish someone had told me.
Yeah, if you have that, could have used can confirm that if you haven't specced into that, I don't have that ability currently.
Right.
That's kind of my last gripe. Is that I love a job system. I absolutely adore it. It's something that is one of my favorite mechanics that JRPGs or RPGs in general can do, and I like the job system here, but if you're going to put something like that in a game, then it becomes, to me at least, very frustrating when you have to have a certain setup in order to go through parts of a game. Like if I have to have this particular ability in order to complete a fight, then why even give me the option?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
Completely agree. And I actually looked into the strong squad layout. It was complete luck. It was after I'd completed the game and I was going on to it for the second time. There was many more guides out by this point because I was doing a quicker run through on the PlayStation. And I was like, just out of curiosity, I wonder what the strongest lineup of job roles and team of four are. And it actually was what I went into the end game when I did it for the first time. And I was like, that could have been a lot worse experience if I hadn't just looked into that. And it wasn't anything to do with skill or knowledge or an intricate knowledge of these things. It was pure fortune. Yeah.
But I think this is like a lowercase a accessibility thing more than anything, like, or legibility thing. Maybe that's the way it is. Because, like, by and large, your generic jobs are very effective in the game, and you can quite effectively negotiate through 90% of that game without really coming into too much of an issue until it's too late and the grind becomes a necessary element of it, which, you know, we've overcame that particular problem with this genre of games some time ago. Like, there is no need to kind of massively grind in modern equivalents of JRPGs. But it comes to a point, though, like, especially if you're using the generic abilities or the job classes, rather. Towards the end of the game, I was essentially only really using one attack or the same attack every time, every single fight, which is not that great, to be honest.
Yeah, it's one of those things where the first 90% of the game, I would try out a new ability just to see what it looked like and be like, oh, that's cool, and then would largely ignore it. And then just do the thing I knew that worked for my mob groups of enemies, you know, in the street. And then, like you said, Carl, you get to those later fights and they become, the difficulty spike's already been mentioned, but it becomes even more than a difficulty spike and more of a, you now being forced to learn these systems that you haven't been forced to engage with before. It's interesting. I've seen some people try to explain that away as like, well, this is how JRPGs work in a lot of sense, especially classic ones. They do have the difficulty spikes at the end, and you need to grind and you need to do these things, which is all true and fine and well and good, but that doesn't make you as the player any more likely to engage with those naturally beforehand so that you're well-equipped for the final 10% of this game or whatever. We could talk about the job system for a long time, but obviously has a lot to it. I think we'll talk about it a little bit more naturally as we move on into the plot. There is, boy, plot. It's the means of telling a story, and this game sure does that in a lot of different ways. Lamar Fitty from the Patreon says, this was my second Yakuza game, the first being Yakuza 0. Having recently completed Persona 5 and having a lot of time on my hands due to the pandemic, I was ready for the switch to RPG mechanics. It was awesome. I enjoyed the fact that I was playing as a ragtag group of middle-aged normal people as opposed to the typical youthful anime protagonists, and was able to relate to the game's hopeful narrative as a result. While Yakuza games cover taboo topics such as prostitution that bring about controversy, I appreciated the fact that this is a video game that does not shy away from those aspects and shines a cultural light on them. I got absorbed in the digital tourism so much that I noticed one of the textures in the karaoke bar contains an excerpt from If, the famous Rudyard Kipling poem. The poem is about keeping your head when others are losing theirs. I can't help but believe that this was an intentional choice, as Ichiban and company continue to travel the courageous path in the midst of political lunacy, hopelessness, and catastrophic life events. Yakuza Like a Dragon is a tale of relentless hope that mirrors life's often unpredictable and schizophrenic nature, both absurd and absurdly moving in equal measure. So, yeah, I really like that because it really is about keeping that positive attitude, and we've already talked about that as is expressed through Ichiban. But when it comes to the plot, there's just no way to do this. Like, I've been beating my head against the wall for the last week of, do we go by chapter? That's boring. Do we talk about characters? Well, we have to. Do we do this? But there's just so much. So the way I've kind of set this conversation up, and it can go wherever it needs to go, is to really focus on our characters more than the individual plot beats. So when we're talking about Ichiban, it's impossible to separate him from Masato Arakawa, who is his essentially his father figure, one of his two father figures growing up, and his unyielding loyalty to Arakawa. And whenever Ichiban interact with Arakawa, whether it was through flashback or modern scenes, the only time you ever see him break down is when he's asking Ichiban to serve jail time in kind of the Arakawa family office. But, like, Arakawa, to me, is just, like, Yakuza cool. Like,
oh, he's so good.
Fedora sporting, wears a black glove to hide the fact that he cut off one of his fingers.
Oh, just, man, that scene.
Like, constantly smoking, and now kids, smoking isn't cool, but in Yakuza, smoking is cool with a capital C.
Being a gangster also not actually cool.
Right,
but
exactly.
It's cool here.
Yes. That dude just, like, from the minute, like, that you see Ichiban's, like, loyalty to him, like, I from outside, I was like, I get it. Yeah, I get that. That's a guy that I could follow into war right there. And he's a nice kind of, he's an emotional center for Ichiban, but he's also a nice throwback to the Yakuza protagonists we've played, or some had played in previous games.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, they put a lot into Arakawa, right? Like, because you start this game with some of his backstory that isn't especially important to the overarching plot, but it kind of shows you where he's coming from and makes him a little bit more human. And when you see how he treats Ichi, and you know how he really treats him, I mean he shot him, but Ichiban's like, not cool, I understand why you did
that's
that.
Affectionate.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like, and wrestling with your siblings, it's just, you know, getting shot, it's fine.
Let's give credit where credit's due. He's a hell of a shot. Missed all the audience. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Perfect shot.
the thing that I like about Arakawa is the kind of like Judas kiss on the cheek use of a Peking duck in that game.
Oh my God. The way that if I you wish want a somebody Peking would just duck. Finally eat the freaking duck. Like, been talking about this duck for 60 hours.
They've built this hierarchical order, haven't they, of, you know, Arakawa at the top, Sawashiro underneath, with Young Master as well, and you've kind of got those different personalities. You totally admire Arakawa and you totally see Ichiban's respect there. You see his falling in line under the strict hardship of Sawashiro, so you start to get like a context of how that environment is. Mm-hmm. The fact that he wants to support Arakawa by caring for the young master, his son, and he takes the time and he does it with a genuine care that clearly others in that faction don't. And then you get that same level of Ichiban looking at his crew. So you've got Adachi, who got kicked out of the police force. You've got Namba, who was failed for selling medical supplies. You've got Zhao, who was tricked by someone within his own faction. Interestingly, Jungi Han, who just seemed to be Korean. You know,
K-pop boy band member.
So if I can just break in for a second here, this is something that I think Brian and I probably experienced differently from you guys.
100%.
Yeah, because Jungi Han is a character in Yakuza 6, and he dies. Like, he is shot in the head. So this isn't the real Jungi Han. And there's a whole, if you go through his side story and his kind of social link stuff, you get a little bit more explanation. Even if you don't, there's kind of a throwaway line like, oh, he was a body double. You get more information about it. But like the first time I saw him, I was second guessing myself. I'm like, wait a minute, didn't he die? Obviously, yes, there is a lot of in the Yakuza games of this person died, oh wait, no, they didn't. Kiryu's died at least four times. Like, right. It keeps happening.
This guy was
pretty graphically dead, like hole in his head type of dead. So that confused me. I think that anybody coming to this for the first time, you know, who had not played the previous games would have just taken that in stride, you know, because there's nothing really weird about it. He's just a dude. But I got there and I was like, wait a minute, I know you. Where
this
did you come from?
This game's answer for that was basically, yeah, he was a body double. Don't
we
think about
cool,
it too much.
So we brought him back from this game.
Don't think about this too much. He was a body double. Yeah. Now move on with your life. That was basically what the game told us to do.
But isn't he cool? Look how cool he is.
Liked his character model, I guess.
Yeah, this character tested well in Korean audiences, so we'll move heaven and earth to get this.
So not to move off the Arakawas for too long, kind of the initial 2.5 or 3 hours of the game, Ichiban's the chauffeur for young Master Arakawa, who is Masato Arakawa's son, who has significant health problems, and travels in a wheelchair mostly, who he's kind of, He's the son of a Yakuza who clearly can't be a Yakuza because of his physical limitations, and that is kind of his emotional center there, kind of dealing with his own physical limitations. It shows... It's a great way to kind of display Ichiban's humanity early there, because young Master Arakawa treats Ichiban like garbage, and Ichiban is still, like, devoted to the family in such a way that he just kind of tries to do everything he can to support young Master Arakawa. But young Master Arakawa dies, in air quotes, Yakuza dies, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah, so Ichiban gets out of prison, and the first person waiting for him there is not Arakawa, as he thought it would be. It's Adachi, who is a DMV employee, which for Americans, that's Department of Motor Vehicles. I'm not sure what it's called in the UK. However, he's a former police officer, and he kind of greets you out of prison by giving you the, hey, and no one's waiting for you. I kind of expected that. Hop in the car, kid. And So the way he felt to me, and I'm not sure if anybody else related to this, he kind of felt like Ichiban's surrogate big brother, in the sense that, like, Ichiban was clearly a tool for Adachi to get closer to his goal, which was to take down the police captain, but you saw him as someone who became very quickly legitimately concerned about Ichiban's future in this new Yakuza world.
Yeah. But I think Adachi was also very aware that Ichi had never done the crime.
Yes, that all, yeah, very true. Yep.
Yeah, that, I mean, that is very clear. So yeah. He does, it's not like he's, there's not a mystery of, well, why does he care? Like, why is he even acknowledging this? It's because he knows that Ichi was innocent and how much has changed since.
Yeah, and a kindred spirit. And I mean, like, this is the Danny Glover of the Yakuza Like a Dragon experience.
So he is.
One year, he was definitely too old for this, and yeah, 1 year away from retirement. Before having his pension taken away from him, which is, I suppose, a fairly believable story. Speaking to somebody who almost certainly will never get to an age where I get a pension, that's going to be quite an interesting thing to do.
Not
I like
to make it to retirement.
Who's she?
Exactly. Yeah. I liked Adachi. I think he's pretty cool. He's down to earth. He sort of has a way of kind of corralling Ichiban in acting like a father figure in the absence of Ichiban's kind of general circle of friends as he escapes out of prison. So it's nice to be there. He's got a cool jacket, too, and gloves.
Very cool jacket. I love that jacket.
I really like the kind of initial set of characters that you are running around with. And I like the ones that you get later on as well. But I thought that kind of friendship between particularly Ichiban, Nanba, and Adachi was really nice, and it felt very believable to me.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, speaking of you, Nanba, we're going to talk about him. Nanba is a former medical professional who basically sews Ichiban up after being shot in a homeless encampment in Yokohama. So this is maybe... So every Yakuza game comes with a disclaimer for me, is that these games are great. However, there are some aspects that may in fact be problematic. And I remember vividly playing this game, getting to Yokohama, starting to do the stuff, getting emotionally invested. And then the way they were treating the homeless encampment was interesting, and I kind of got involved in that. And then I went out and I started fighting enemies, and I saw the way they kind of treated the homeless problem with a little bit more levity than I appreciated. The example I put down here was that there are enemies that you fight that are called Hungry Hungry Homeless, which is a play on Hungry Hungry Hippos, which is a board game. And there's no mention at all of mental health concerns, which I think that anyone who has been around a homeless population, as I have been, and if anybody who lives in any American city center could probably say that there is a gigantic mental health concern when it comes to the homeless population. And the way that it treated this kind of for laughs in certain aspects, or certainly for laughs first in a couple aspects, rubbed me the wrong way. It was probably the one part of this game that I remember playing and being just kind of like, yo, like, really? Like, we're doing this? Like, did anybody else feel that? Am I, like, is that...
So there's a point very early on after Ichiban, you know, it has been has had his bullet wound tended to, and he's, you know, trying to figure out where he goes from here. And I think this is partially effective in kind of setting him up as this naive person who maybe is a little bit too optimistic and too simplistic. But also I think that it just, I'm not sure that it gets there all the way if that is what they are using it for.
Sure.
He just kind of is in, he's talking about going to the Hello Work, the place where you actually get your jobs and are able to switch them later on in the game. And, he just kind of is like, well, the reason that you guys are still homeless is because you haven't looked for work. You have to do that. And I have in my notes, this guy's really just about to go out there and solve homelessness, huh? It's like I think that they were just trying to show how clueless he is. But to me, it almost comes off as just a, I don't like how you set your hero up to say that kind of thing, you know?
Right. It's so, the Ichiban equivalent of pick yourself up by your bootstraps comment. Yes. Yeah.
I'm primed for this conversation because this
go off.
I haven't been on the other Yakuza shows because I refused to play them. After playing Yakuza 1, I found it the kind of ethics that sit behind some of this to be quite disgusting, to be honest with you. And like reprehensible in Yakuza Zero in particular was the depiction of foreign people, and for me that hasn't really changed much in this game as well. It's the same like rote xenophobic tropes of what Yakuza games do, which is basically depicting in particular Chinese nationals as the kind of arbiters of petty crime, whereas the noble Yakuza are in there doing the great work that governments and local councils simply can't do because they're too tied up with bureaucracy. That is a really problematic libertarian take on how high capitalism and organized criminals can do a much better job than a democratically elected public. That is there and there. But I want to wheel back to the depiction of homeless people in this game, which I think... I'm going to be honest with you. When I first finished this game, I thought it was pretty vile. Like, I think it's like not at all agreeable to depict homeless people as like for the yucks, for laughs, like hungry homeless, a man in a trash bag, basically with like nothing on in his legs. It is in keeping with the kind of like levity that the rest of the game has in depictions of like people who are like sexual deviants or things like that. That's just the way that Yakuza is. I can make my peace with that. Having said that, I went back into the game, played it about a month ago, ready to experience that same level of disgust that I had here. In the conversation that Leia referenced, thanks for bringing that up because you've done my heavy lifting. There was definitely a section in there that was like being homeless is not a choice. Like, homelessness is, and we in the UK have just undergone one of our former Home Secretaries, which made the distinction that homelessness was a choice, and it fundamentally isn't, and the game makes it quite clear that that is actually true in here. So it's actually quite informative and reflective of what I consider to be good politics and good ethics. How I just find it still really difficult to sort of make my peace with the fact that we're having a conversation about homelessness and, like, the inability of people to function in a society which isn't catered for homelessness, and everybody's kind of coming out having lessons learned, and then all of a sudden you're in a battle and Namba's vomiting on people having drank a load of drink. It's still the kind of dissonance that sits behind there. It still feels like too much for me personally, and I don't think this game cures a lot of the problems. I think the depiction of homelessness is problematic. Even if it is good-spirited in one section, it kind of undoes it with the other. And the way that it still has the kind of, like, pandering to Japanese nationalists and xenophobic approach towards Korean people as, like, you know, criminals of, like, cybercrimes, or Chinese people as petty criminals who are into larceny and
literally
beating people up. It's just
mysterious
cannot.
Foreigners siphoning energy from the good, hardworking Japanese people. It's how that's presented as the Koreans, for sure.
Exactly. Yep. And I just wish it wasn't the case. I really wish it wasn't the case, because we wouldn't have a game in which, you know, in the UK we had like South Asian nationals who ran petty crimes. In America, I imagine you wouldn't have, it wouldn't fly if you had a game of like Mexican migrants or Cuban migrants who came in and just did all the crimes while the New York kind of Wall Street people did like all of the corporate crimes.
So I think those games do exist, but I don't think that they are glossed over quite like it is in Yakuza.
I don't think it gets a pass. Like, you know, I'll listen to a couple
of
different...
Well, not from everybody, but what I'm saying is sure. from the larger part of the audience, I guess.
Sure.
But yep. I just think as a kind of consumer, we need to kind of come to terms with the fact that this is a problematic depiction of, like, lifestyles. Like, it would be in your face to experience that in a Grand Theft Auto. Like, a Grand Theft Auto game, like, has that kind of relationship. You'll have a Cuban gang. But, like, it's not done in a philanthropic way, when we don't look up to these heroes, these people as heroes, the anti-heroes, in the way that in Yakuza, like, you sort of come away from it thinking, like, oh, yeah, Kiryu's a great guy. No, he's not. He's a criminal. Like, he's a criminal and a member of a criminal organization, or a former member of a criminal organization. Yeah. Like, this is very difficult for me to pass, like, at an ethical level. So, and I still don't know where I land on it.
Yeah, I don't think I do either. And I know that I've come across as much more positive on these games than you have. However, I do see Ichiban at very minimum a sort of a course correction on this, even if the set dressing hasn't necessarily been altered sufficiently enough. I do see, like, Ichiban is someone who is, you know, welcoming and accepting of all, and is obviously a very, you know, ethically sound human being and all those things. But it doesn't change the fact that people also think he's nuts for being that way. So, like, you know, like it's an interesting evolution for this franchise that I agree with you. I don't think it quite nails it, or maybe in some places even comes close to nailing it or being respectful of whether it's other cultures or different socioeconomic classes. I do think it's a step in the right direction, but I also think that the things that you saw as xenophobic in the other games that I agree with in retrospect, those didn't hit me in the face as much as seeing the words hungry, hungry, homeless on the screen that literally made me, like, take pause. And I don't know how to reconcile that within myself, because obviously this is a game that I love. You know, we've talked about that already. But there are moments in it that do make me kind of, like, the tire screeching sound moments of being like, this is just, there's something about it that feels just not right in that moment. And then it's maybe breathe, or as Leah said, glossed over in other ways. I don't know how to make heads or tails of that myself either. I don't have the answer to that question. I just know that I have questions. So beyond that, Namba, you kind of build out your core party after this with an interaction with a soap landowner who appears to commit suicide, but it turns out was murdered. And this is kind of the plot device in which you're introduced to Saiko, who is the last four of your core four first party members, because she is the sister of a woman who worked at that soap land, and you kind of become entrenched with her. And are they twins, actually, or are they just look alike? Okay, they are twins.
Yeah.
They're twins.
So yeah, you get introduced to her, and you kind of have now your ragtag band of characters. And I don't want to not give Saiko the same due we gave Adachi and Namba, because Saiko becomes a really, in my opinion, a key emotional center of this game, particularly as it relates to Ichiban, because Saiko's relationship with the party as kind of like it looks like it's going to be ham-fisted. This is my take at the beginning, because she's like the one girl, and like Namba's like being really weird around her because she's like, oh, it's a girl, we're hanging out with a female, like all these things. And she just kind of pushes past what have been the previous gender roles that have kind of been set up by the series, and just kind of, and I don't want this to blend into like, oh, she's just one of the guys, because that's problematic in its own way. But she separates herself as a competent, successful individual on her own merits, and is not reliant on the needs of the men around her to be successful and to be competent. And I think that makes her a very strong character, a character that I like. Her conversations in the bar and her interactions with the party became ones that I became very invested in.
Tell me more about what it's like to be a woman in a primarily male environment.
So let me, Leah, let me explain this to you, okay? Can I?
Thanks. Break this down? Okay, yeah, go ahead. Seriously though, I think you are right on the money here. She has a different role, and I mentioned before that I really like that kind of combination of the three kind of initial characters that you get to, and she fits in really well to that. I think this is another place where Ichiban kind of, it just comes off as a good guy because he respects what is different here. But like when they're all going to, you know, hang out and drink beer and whatever, and, you know, she's just kind of standing there looking a little bit sad because, you know, these are her friends, you know, and she doesn't really have another place to go. And it's almost like it never really occurred to him that she would want to hang out with them.
Right,
When she does, she kind of takes her place. You know, everybody's got their own little niche to fill in this party, I suppose. And I think she settles into hers just as well as any of the other characters. Now, Aerie, poor Aerie. Oh, I feel bad for Aerie.
Is Aerie an optional? My question for you guys is: Aerie an optional character? If you don't interact with the, we'll get to that in a little bit. I know we're getting a little long in time, but I don't think she has to be in your party. I ended up using her quite a bit.
But yet, no, she's not in any of the cutscenes, if you notice that. Like,
yes.
I think I'm not sure whether that means that. She is definitely an optional character because you don't even get the opportunity to recruit her until you finish the Ichiban Holdings mini game.
Yes.
But regardless of when that actually happens, it almost feels like she was an afterthought, and she may have been, like, they may have added her as a playable character later on. I don't know, but it feels like that because the most that she interacts with the rest of your party is you occasionally get kind of side conversations that you can have that will raise your relationship level just a little bit with the characters involved if you read through the whole thing. And she has a couple of those with some of the other characters in the party, but she's not in any of the cutscenes. She, when you're in your little hideaway, she's sitting off by herself with like a laptop or something.
On a laptop,
in a corner,
exactly.
Basically. Yeah. So, you know, she never, her whole social link storyline is related to that mini game. So you never have, just like you do with everybody else, that you can go over to her and have a chat in the bar. She's just kind of there. And I get it. I understand why they did it, but it's kind of a shame because I would have liked to see more of her interacting with the actual story.
Yeah. No, I agree completely.
Strong, strong Vincent Valentine vibes in that regard.
Yeah,
you know?
Actually.
So yeah, you kind of got into that a little bit with Aerie Chan there, and one of the biggest antagonists in the Yokohama section is a group known as Bleach Japan, which we're an hour and 50 minutes into this podcast we haven't talked about yet, but they're basically their goal is to bleach Japan, which is to get rid of all the gray areas, which they would consider like petty crime or maybe like socially acceptable but not fully legal things such as soap lands. Maybe they're flirting with the idea of prostitution and drug trade and things of that nature. And Kume, who is the kind of face of that group, is a really not enjoyable punch in the face boy who I like to not like very much. But what you learn through this and you gain other party members like Jun Gihan, previously mentioned, Zhao, who we've barely talked about, who is another party member, who it seems like Emo Majima to me, who I love very much. He was the head of the Seryu clan, and they join your party as you start to unveil these political machinations, because lo and behold, Yakuza Young Arakawa was not actually dead, but went to the U.S. for experimental medical treatment and is now a prominent political figure who goes by the name Ryo Aoki. And you kind of assemble this crew of badasses to try to take down the political influences that are they're kind of this, through the efforts of Bleach Japan, Ryo Aoki. Every member of your party has emotional investment into not letting them take over Yokohama. This is how I felt about this, and I'd be interested to hear your guys' thoughts. Junki Han and Zhao, while cool and while great party members, when I think of the story of this game, I do not think of them primarily. I think of I think of Ichiban, Nanba, Adachi, and Saiko. Those are like my core four. And while Junki Han and Zhao are very important to the story, very important part members of your party, they're not the characters I identified with as much.
I was kind of surprised when I got Zhao as a party member.
Right,
like,
yeah.
I was not expecting that. They're both connected to two-thirds. Junki Han and Zhao are connected to two-thirds of the, they call it the Great Wall of Muscle, which is kind of the crime
the
syndicate.
Yeah.
Yes, the crime syndicate network, I guess, that it has been controlling the city, and everything falls apart due to Ryo Aoki, who is actually not Ryo Aoki. He's Arakawa, who is not really Arakawa. He's Sawashiro's son, because, and here's the kicker, folks. There were two babies in the lockers.
What?
Right next to each other, which I put down the controller and I laughed at that one, 'cause I'm like, really? Are you serious right now? Yeah, you hear kind of the story of how Arakawa, now Aoki, came to be, basically, and how he was as a child, and the whole kind of drama there. And then you don't find out until much later that that's not the real story, and that that Ichiban is Arakawa's actual son, mm-hmm. because he was in the locker next door and Arakawa punched open the wrong locker to get to him.
Yeah, that's one of, in my opinion, because we have time for my lofty opinions in this podcast.
Sure.
Now,
of course.
That's one of the all-time great cutscenes in video games when he
it is incredible.
Punches yeah. open a coin locker and retrieves a baby and then runs screaming through the crowd with a baby that's still alive. I mean, slow clap, dripping with drama, just punch the air. What a moment. Just like, I remember... And not to be too romantic about this, but like I already loved this game. And then when that stuff started happening, I was just like, wow, like did somebody write this for me? Did somebody like decide that, man, it just doesn't.
I remember when I pulled my son out of the locker.
yeah. Everybody's got a story. A tale as old as time.
So close to home.
it encapsulates the absurdity of the series in such a cool way. Those moments just really meant a lot. It's so silly to say, but they mean a lot to me. Like that moment, like it builds these characters in a way that make them lovable, hateable, relatable, whatever. It's just, it's kind of masterfully done.
There's so, like, I sincerely mean this. There's so much, like, as absurd as the premise of that particular scene is, like, there is a lot of pathos in the performance. Like, yeah. It is incredibly well acted for something like that. The emotion, the kind of voice acting, everything kind of culminates in an incredibly kind of affecting scene. So, like, I'm right there with you, yeah. despite my reservations about the game.
This is not a ham-fisted attempt to wrap this up at all. We have more to talk about, and we won't have time to talk about it all. But the story, I would say, is satisfactorily... convoluted in the way that Yakuza games are. Now, my question for you guys is that does the convoluted nature of the end of the story ruin it for you at all? Because I feel like in the previous entries, I have had criticisms of that towards the end. But most of my criticisms are overshadowed by the, you know, high five, we're doing this together, we're a group, we're the kings, you know, whatever.
By the drama!
Yes.
Check out all the drama. Yeah.
Yakuza is well-worn territory for the false reveal of the fifth villain in the last hour. Was this something that was problematic for any of you, or was this something that you just have come to expect?
I think we know my answer for this, so I'm just gonna step back.
Honestly, no, it wasn't a problem for me. The core reason is that, like many 80s movies that I've watched, it was never about the context of the story and the drama and everything around it. It was the band of brothers.
Yeah, it's the people you upset along the way, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, the fact that I was doing it with my party of, I mean, it's so cheesy and cliche to say it, but they're like genuinely like friends, because you've spent so much time with them. You've had all the conversations in the bar, so you've done their bonding levels. You've had all the conversations when you go out and take them for meals, which, by the way, brilliant element of the game. And you get all these like stories of communications when you're talking past landmarks, and those trigger. So by that point, I feel like I know these people. I'm honestly, it could have gone more wild in terms of the end, and maybe even more frustrating, and I'd have still forgiven it because I was there with the group of my team that I just loved playing with. And I know that's a bit of a cop out, really, but
I feel mostly the same way.
I love the game.
Cop out or not, it is. It does become, I mean, how many people could tell you, like, a nice synopsis at the end of a Final Fantasy VII competently and know all the beats of the story? But I bet a lot of people could tell you how much they feel for Tifa and Aerith and Barret, you know? So it's I think that's well-worn territory in the genre, for better or worse.
And I think maybe I'm more forgiving of it because of the fact that it's an RPG over an action brawler. Maybe that's also a factor in there. You know, I'm not an individual fighting against everything else in a political sense that I would have been if I was just Kiryu trying to smash my way through everything. I'm actually doing it as a group in a slower paced environment. I'm maybe more forgiving. I'm able to digest stuff in different kinds of ways of what those story beats are, to take the bits that mean something to me and resonate and leave the bits that don't. And I think that also plays a huge part in that I'm maybe not as forgiving about in.
Yeah.
Other Yakuza games from what I've seen, or even, you know, Man Who Erased His Name, which I've done, all these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so moving past the main plot, that's much like every other Yakuza game, it has a wealth of side activities ones can do. We'll hit the new ones. We've already talked about Ichiban Confections, or Ichiban Holdings, quite a bit, which is essentially it's an idle game, sort of, property management / boardroom simulator.
Sounds so boring. Yeah, it's so good.
It covers the thrills and spills of building an empire of sex dungeons and erotic literature outlets all across Yokohama. You know,
I guess we know what your company did.
Listen, I know where the bread is buttered. Okay,
see,
like, this is where the real money is.
Here's the thing: is that I tried to have a sex dungeon empire, but it turned out that there were things that were more profitable than that, so I kind of had to pivot. But yeah, listen, sex dungeons were part of it. We'll put it that way.
One of the ones that I found myself interacting with the most, or at least to its completion, was the movie watching.
I
loved fighting off those sheep-headed men in suits who were trying to lull me to
Catherine, massive Catherine vibes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So that was obviously new. We had the can quest, which was in the homeless encampment where you're collecting cans, an early way to kind of make money and to gain items. Dragon cart, which is a whole other thing that you can get invested with. Now, Leah, I know you did this to the most part. I never found this too challenging, but it did hit the bug with me of, you know, it's, upgrading your cart and doing the thing and collecting the rings so I could get I think I got like a big ass ladle for my cook out of getting enough rings or whatever. But yeah.
Yo, you like Mario Kart?
Yeah.
Because this is Mario Kart.
Yeah.
Quite as good.
Yeah. it doesn't have quite as many tracks. Actually, I have not. Maybe I should go back and try and do that. I never found the last guy because I went through all of the kind of rival quests. And then the last dude goes, hey, I got to go do something before I race you. And he never came back.
Yeah,
so I don't know.
Yeah, I did finish it. And honestly, there's not really that much to get out of it. It's mostly just another kind of way to access a great deal of money. It's perfunctory racing around Yokohama. It's absolutely fine. It's just that it's like, you know, I'm not really sure what to say about it more than that.
I don't know that there really is much more.
Yeah. So there was Dragon Kart. I spent a lot of time with it. Whether or not it's good, I don't know. At some point, I just don't know anymore. There's the vocational school, which people have mentioned several times, which are just like trivia quizzes, sometimes about the history of Sega, sometimes about Japanese landmarks, sometimes about random knowledge. The only thing I say about this, it's a great way to upgrade your stats as Ichiban. It's also really I'm not sure what's more fun, the cutscene if you win, where four randoms throw you up in the air, or the cutscene where you fail, where a single solitary businessman comes up and shakes his head and puts his hand on
your
shoulder.
It's so good. And do you know what? There's that sort of anticipation of finding out as well that you genuinely kind of feel as he pulls the paper out of the envelope that I absolutely adored about that little game. It was
too
so
real.
Dumb, but I loved it.
Yeah, too real. Waiting for the results to come back.
The disappointment of exam results to come out.
And then we also had the romance workshop, which was, it's not really much a side of activity as it is just a way to build up your weapons, but you can invest in the workshop to make the workshop to be able to make more weapons or to upgrade your weapons even further. That's a pretty big money sink.
It really is. Yes. Yeah, and it goes way further on than what it needs to in order to actually finish the base game, I would say. Like way further on than what you would expect it to.
It's like 10 or 20 million yen to get it to the, get it to the last upgrade.
And it's all about like material drops in the final Millennium Tower. So, yeah, it's very grindy.
Sombori Arena as well.
Yes.
You kind of need to do that grind as well. I mean, it's a two-way grind, isn't it? You've got to grind for more money for the, and then you've got to grind for the actual materials.
Right. And that brings me to the next one, which is the Sombori Arena / the Sewer Dungeon, which are technically optional. But would you say those are optional? Because the only way I could beat Majima... And that fight was I had to do that Sotenbori dungeon like 7 or 8 full times to level up my party to get high enough. So optional might be kind of a loaded term there.
It's kind of nice that they put it in there though, because like they know you're gonna need to grind. Like I don't like that they put in things that they know you're going to need to grind for. But if you're gonna do it, then you might as well have a pretty clear spot where that's expected.
The Sotenbori Arena is also the first place that actually teaches you about elemental effects. Really, in that kind of environment prior to the essentially the Millennium Towers.
Yeah, but the Sotenbori Arena quickly becomes obsolete when you're going for like the Platinum Trophy and the, because there's the Millennium Tower in the base game, then there's an extended Millennium Tower or a more difficult version of it, and then there is the highest possible level. And I don't know, Carl, if you did this or not, but.
I'm sick, so I did it twice.
In that Millennium Tower, you have to do all of it. All of the enemies are level 99, and all of the bosses, all of the key bosses that Leah was talking about before. So, Mirrorface, I forgot his actual name, Kiryu, Majima, Saijima, all of those bosses within this one fight. It's
Tendo.
Grotesque.
Let's not forget Tendo.
Oh, of course.
I don't think I'm going to do that.
You actually have to grind the sewers for the vagabonds.
Yeah. Oh, those ones that run away.
The metal slimes of the Yakuza world. Oh,
so you've got to basically use Jungi Han's rapid fire on the vagabonds to get the experience to boost all your jobs up quick, and then you need to do basically the vast majority of your jobs to about 50%. Because the jobs do carry across to your total level, and then you need the key skills for stuff like, you know, the champagne popping one, which you can actually use on a different kind of job role. Like, there's a whole other like world of insane grinding, but it kind of built for the grind. Right. It's weird.
So is this the part where we spend 2 hours talking about Balatro?
Oh my god! Yeah, I'll be right back. I'm gonna get a pizza or something.
And last and certainly not least, and strictly for the essence of time, this game also has a full suite of sub stories, side quests, 51 of them in total. My standouts personally were Nancy Chan, who is a crawfish, we would call them here, and that you can save and then use as a summon. I also am a big fan, and I'm not sure if this will make it into the final edit. If it needs to be edited out, I apologize. The Piss Wizard, which is finding to find who is urinating into the river, the giant Roomba, the man babies, and then a particularly series of three sub-stories in the park with an animal performer who does not know how to lock his cages. I fought a chimpanzee operating a piece of heavy machinery. I fought a bear. Uh-huh. I fought a giant tiger. It was wonderful. So
you fight several tigers in this game. Tigers are disturbingly common as enemies.
In terms of sub-stories, are we not talking about the spicy soup?
Oh, please. Yeah.
Which... tremendous. You've got the girl who's going to die if the last fruit falls off the tree, so you've got to fight a sumo wrestler and a sniper. As you do. And also on a slightly different tangent, the hunting for the statues.
Kappa
statues
and the cats too.
And the cats, you have to go and find the cats, but the Kappa statues I tried to do legitimately and I caved at 8 out of 10. They were so hard to find. I spent literal hours looking at them and I refused to look at a guide, and eventually I was like, I genuinely can't. I was going on and starting after work and playing for hours and then turning the game off, and all I'd been doing was looking for Kappa statues in the city.
This is a change from Yakuza 6, which I was very happy with, is sub-stories are indicated on the map. So you can just go find
them.
Sure are. As opposed to naturally coming across them.
And also, you can put markers on the map that will then just give you a line to your marker on the mini-map.
Yeah.
And as somebody who is directionally challenged, I really appreciate that. I get lost super easily.
Also... we mentioned the whole Tsuji Dex, but we never mentioned all of Part-Time Hero.
Yes, yeah, the Part-Time Hero quest.
Which is just an insane amount of additional quests for XP that are in this game. Like a staggering amount.
It is an absolute smorgasbord of things to do, and I think you could probably use that as both a criticism and a compliment.
But if you criticize it, you're right.
Right. Your mileage will vary, I think, of what you're willing to engage with. But if you are willing to engage with it, there is a depth to almost everything.
Yeah. Huge variety.
Sometimes I would just run around in the park and collect bugs.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
You can do that.
You can. Literally spend a night doing it because you need those materials for upgrading.
So before we get to our summaries, we had a lot of forum correspondence. Some of this I am going to amend for the sake of time. That does not mean we don't appreciate it. Please head on over to kanarins.com on the forums, where we do have the ability to comment on all the games that we'll be recording episodes on. And also you can head to our Patreon, patreon.com/kanarins, where you can comment on the upcoming episodes, get the extended cut of this issue, which, let's face it, is going to be pretty long. And if you're listening to that, we thank you very much for your contributions. Tolkien Taters from the forum says, "This is my favorite Yakuza game. Ichiban is an inverse of Kiryu. He's an obnoxious, over-the-top dumbass who can't stay quiet, and I love him. The fact that his character suit is also an inverted version of Kiryu's is a great detail. He's a pivotal element of this game because he's just so endearing. As usual, the insane twist-filled melodramatic storyline was extremely entertaining and compelling, even if you could argue it's too convoluted for its own good. But that's the Yakuza way." Moving on to Tom Fum, who says, "I loved every moment I played. Becoming homeless, can-collecting, business-owning, fighting oversized granny and cat-sucking Roombas, fighting circus animals, kart racing. What more could you ask for? Walking around Yokohama was magical. I even pointed out to my mom the places we had walked around in real life, be it on a smaller scale, but the Chinese temple shrine and one of the buildings on the waterfront are actually real. It was a lovely reminder of being in the place for real." And last but not least, two more. Jobo Bonomo says, "To sum up, Like a Dragon has been a true triumph in their first foray into turn-based RPG antics. It integrates old elements of the series with new so elegantly that I urge anyone who is skeptical of the change in gameplay to give it a go. Right up there with Yakuza 0 as a must-play of the series. P.S. I was also happy when the sad sub-story music of 0 returned." Me too. Me too.
Yeah.
And last but not least, Veronica Jane from the Patreon says, "After playing every Yakuza game in a year, starting with Judgment and ending with Yakuza 6, God love you, that's a lot of games, I was maybe starting to get a little burnt out on my favorite series. And then I don't know why. And then along comes Like a Dragon to revitalize the whole thing with a brand new combat system, a brand new proper sized city, and most importantly, a brand new and much improved protagonist. Sorry, Kiryu, you know I love you, but after 30 years of gaming and the grim and serious man just doesn't interest in me anymore. How could that stoic nunny possibly compare to a full-throated blah? Not that Kiryu didn't have emotions, of course, but Ichiban has every emotion turned up to 11, and he is a joy to watch. Ichiban also has friends, which I never realized was missing in Yakuza. Sure, Kiryu has friends, but only in cutscenes or in the final assault where they show up for 30 seconds and then decide to stay behind to hold off the goons while Kiryu goes to the final battle alone. Ichiban is surrounded by friends at all times, chatting about food, discussing the weird T-Rex statues, and just shooting the breeze about whatever comes to mind. From using an app to call a crayfish for combat help, to staying awake in boring movies, to sudden forays in politics, I adored every part of this game. Okay, maybe the random encounters got tiresome by the end, but the real-time fights in every other Yakuza game got tired by the end too. And I'm glad to see the future of the series is in strong, baseball-wielding hands. Thank you to everybody, and sorry if I had to amend your submissions. And now, as always, we put out a call on X for 3-word reviews from you, the people that listen.
Jobo Bonobo says, Ichiban's stunning debut.
WTFDYW says, Almighty Digger Chimp.
Kurt Lewin says, Ruined by Grinding.
Fox McButt Jr., great name, says, Very long cutscenes.
Awesome Wells, Punch Perm Heroes.
And finally, Julian Titus says, Sweet, lovable himbo.
I do love a himbo.
Who doesn't? are we himbos? Am I a himbo? I don't know.
Great himbo protagonist.
So
I don't think any of you guys are dumb enough to be himbos, but...
Well, thanks. Yeah. That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me.
You're welcome.
So I think in summary here, it's tough, right? We try to go from least positive to most positive. And I'm not sure if I'm going to nail it or not. However, I do think that a lot of us think... sorry, I'm laughing at me misspelling my own name. Let's take it again. I'm not sure if we nailed it officially, but I think we have a pretty good run here. And we certainly have a 4 people that have opinions about this game. So, Rich, why don't we start with you and we'll see where we go.
I think you got me right. Look, I genuinely like this game. Really, the shortest summary I could possibly give is that I, having finished Yakuza 0, knew there and then that if the rest of the 6 games in that particular series at the point of recording were anything like that, there was just no way I was going to go around and play them. I felt very confident that the gameplay wasn't for me. The kind of tone and setting was a little bit offensive to me. It's not quite the same with Yakuza Like a Dragon. Actually, to play as a game, I find it quite enjoyable. It's very long. It has a lot of scope to make improvements. As a platform, I think there's loads of opportunities there to do really good stuff. And I'm looking forward to playing the next in the series. I do just want to kind of reiterate, however, I don't think it solves the problems that I encountered in the first instance. I think there's some pretty deplorable depictions of foreign people. I think there's also some really problematic depictions of homelessness, and I don't think it does a great job of actually tackling some of the kind of sexism that sits underneath it as well. However, as a game, you know, I am probably about 2 nights away from the platinum. I may get there, I may not, and I think I wouldn't have even considered doing that if I didn't enjoy the game wholly. So it is a kind of mild recommend for me. I think if this is the future of the Yakuza series, it's probably one that I can get on board with. So it's an all-in-all success, more than what I expected it to be.
Thanks, Rich. I'm going to go next, and I think the last thing the world needs is another tearful, long-winded summary by me on a Kanan Rants episode. So what I will say about this is that Yakuza as a whole has become just a big part of my life. I'm wearing an Ichiban hoodie today, and I didn't wear it because we were recording this episode. I wore it because I wear an Ichiban hoodie 4 days out of the week. I'm a big fan. This game was the game that got me into the other games, which then led me to what has maybe become my favorite video game franchise of all time. It has a lot of problems, has issues, but it will not stop the fact that I just enjoy being in those worlds with these characters and really just adore playing these video games. I think it's a cliff that I have willingly fallen off of, and I I think that if you listen this far, you already know that. I'd like to think that if you gave it a shot, at least, even if you don't enjoy it, you could see maybe what some of us have enjoyed about it. And I am recording this podcast on the road today. I am on a trip with some of my friends. We are visiting a video game arcade. I know, shocking that I would go on a trip just for video games. However, I Skype called with my children last night before they went to bed. And my six-year-old son got on the Skype call and said, in his best Goro Majima impression, "Kiryu-chan." And honestly, like, these games have become a part of my life. They're synonymous with who I am as a person now, and it's hard to kind of be completely objective about them. But what I will say, having being 50 hours into the next game in the franchise, and will play whatever offering they give up next, that this game in and of itself is a really good building block for the future that they seem to have executed on moving forward. And for that, I'm very thankful. And I think this game has a lot that it can improve on, that they are showing signs now that they are taking active steps to improve on. So, total recommend for me. Leah.
Ryan, I approve of your parenting.
Thank you.
That's good stuff. I do not have an Ichiban hoodie, but I did wear my Saejima parka
yes.
to the grocery store today, and a nice little old man said, "Is that a tiger on your back?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And I did not explain to him where it was from, but he was very nice and said that he liked my jacket. I think Brian's already said a lot of what I want to say, minus the parenting stuff, because nobody's making that mistake. thank you. I like Yakuza a whole lot. If it's not my favorite series, it's really, really close. It's one that I will probably never have reservations about going into a Yakuza title. It's done enough for me, and I have learned to know what I'm getting into and that I'm gonna love it. And despite I've had some issues with this game that I think I've talked about enough, but despite those, I'm still thinking like, oh man, I'm gonna go back and I'm gonna play this and I'm gonna get through that, and maybe I'll need to grind a little bit, but so what? Grinding is more playing the game, and you know, I'm all right with that. So I recommend this game pretty highly. In fact, especially if you've liked the other Yakuza games but want to see kind of what a slightly different twist on it is, it's got those moments in there for if you have played Yakuza before. Like, I obviously did the "It's Majima!" before he kicked my butt a half a dozen times. I get a kick out of that kind of stuff. So regardless of whether you haven't experienced a Yakuza game before, I think this is a perfectly good place to jump in, see if you like it. It's got an interesting system that I, as a JRPG fan, I don't think it's perfect, but I think it's pretty decent for a first shot at it within this series. I'd give this a try. It is frequently on sale and it's available pretty much everywhere. So I don't think it's still on Game Pass, is it? Probably not. But
I think it came on Game Pass when the new game released. I think it relaunched on Game Pass, I believe.
It may actually also be on the PlayStation Plus game library.
Ooh, yeah,
depending on what subscription you have. It's out there. It's easily accessible, and I do recommend it. Give it a shot.
Thanks, Leah. And last but certainly not least, Carl.
So there's two important aspects that I want to look at about how this game is quite important to me. So the first is that we obviously got the new launch of the consoles, the Xbox Series machines and the PS5. And we had these beautiful looking games that were advertised, but there was only Yakuza Like a Dragon that interested me, that really was pulling my attention, that I felt I had to play. And that's always exciting when something lures you in around a console launch. The very important times, and there's just something special about that. But more importantly, it released in 2020. Now, 2020 was obviously quite a difficult year for a lot of different people when it came to, you know, things like lockdown and all the kinds of things that came with that. But it was also an incredible year for games. So Yakuza Like a Dragon released at the same year as The Last of Us Part 2, Half-Life Alyx, Ghost of Tsushima, Spider-Man Miles Morales, Hades, Animal Crossing New Horizons. There's some huge games. Oh, Final Fantasy VII Remake. Let's keep it topical. We've referenced it already in this podcast. And Yakuza Like a Dragon is not my favorite game released in 2020. And that's only because The Last of Us Part 2 might actually be my favorite game ever made. But it was comfortably the second best game that I played that year. And I got so excited with every aspect of that game as I was playing it in a way that I very seldom do. I watched every single essence skill. I had to unlock them so I could see the animation when I was doing an essence skill. I had to see every single pound, mates. And yes, some of those are very expensive. I never skipped a cutscene or a conversation or a side conversation or a food conversation, all these other elements of the game that just had so much depth. And, you know, I never felt that I was short on time or that I wanted to end my time with this game. So much so that I didn't shut up in the Kane & Rince Slack channel, and then Brian started playing and I got dead excited when Brian started to click with the game. And that was a huge thing for me because I hadn't shut up about it. I bought a physical copy of it for James on the podcast. I bought copies for several of my friends. I bought it on PlayStation. I bought it on Xbox and completed it on Xbox, then completed it on PlayStation and convinced a good friend of mine to play it. And then I watched him stream it. There's quite a lot that I have seen multiple times of in this game and experienced and played several times and done the grind. And do you know what? I'm still phenomenally positive about how good this game is. It's not perfect. It never tries to be perfect. It doesn't try and refine its content to the point that it could ever be perfect. And I kind of love that open honesty in games design of, we're going to put heart and soul into everything. It's not going to click for everyone and it's not going to be super polished, but we care about it and we think that you'll enjoy it. And I really did, in a way that, for me, way surpasses the other Yakuza games that I also really like. And that's why this game, I just recommend it to everyone. Even people who are, I don't like RPGs, I don't like turn-based, give it a go. Seriously, it is such an inviting avenue into JRPGs that could open up a whole other special world for you of incredible titles like Personas and Final Fantasies, etc. And if this is your gateway drug into one of the best genres in video games, so be it. Play it. It is such a great game with a phenomenal cast of characters.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for contributing to this, going along with me on this journey. I really appreciate all of you being here. So thank you both, thank you all to Rich, Leah, and Carl, Editor Jay, as well as our correspondents, plus all of you for listening to us talk about this game. And next time, in issue 611, we jump through the Mustached Plumber's first adventure on the Game Boy with Super Mario Land.